Hello, I'm David Cannadine, editor of the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography. This is an abridged extract from the dictionary's new entry on Margaret Thatcher, written by me, which we added to the ODNB in January 2017. The full biography of Margaret Thatcher is available on the ODNB website, and you'll find further audio extracts on the website and on the dictionary's SoundCloud page. In this extract, I tell the story of Margaret Thatcher's political demise, which culminated in her resignation as Prime Minister in November 1990. Since the autumn of 1986, Margaret Thatcher had been increasingly worried that the British economy was overheating. And there was another subject on which she came to disagree with her Chancellor of the Exchequer, Nigel Lawson. For Lawson, like his predecessor Geoffrey Howe, was in favour of joining the Exchange Rate Mechanism, or ERM, a policy to which the Prime Minister was viscerally hostile from 1985 to 1990. But it was widely understood that one day Britain would indeed join the ERM, and Lawson began to prepare the ground by trying to align sterling with the Deutschmark. Thatcher was flatly opposed to this policy, and to strengthen her hand in dealing with Lawson, she brought back Alan Walters, who had worked for her between 1981 and 1983, to be her economic adviser. To complicate matters still further, she was becoming increasingly antagonistic to the European Community and to its president Jacques Delors, and in this view she was reinforced by Charles Powell, who had been her private secretary for international affairs since 1984, but who was by this time widely regarded as her de facto foreign secretary. Powell's hand was much in evidence in the speech Thatcher delivered at Bruges in September 1988, where she said many complimentary things about Britain's destiny being in Europe, but the most memorable sentence gave a very different message. "We have not successfully rolled back the frontiers of the state in Britain," she argued, "only to see them reimposed at a European level, with a European superstate exercising a new dominance from Brussels." To Geoffrey Howe and Nigel Lawson alike, these views were anathema. The long festering disagreements between Howe and Lawson on the one hand and Thatcher on the other finally erupted in June 1989 at the European Council meeting in Madrid. They both argued that Thatcher should undertake to join the ERM by the end of 1992. But she refused to follow their advice on the grounds that the time was not right, which effectively left her isolated in the European Community. She thought that Howe and Lawson had backed her into a corner. And in July, she took out her rage and frustration by sacking Howe from the Foreign Office, where she replaced him with John Major, and making him Leader of the Commons instead. Although she gave him the title of Deputy Prime Minister, the demotion of Howe was widely regarded as vindictive and ungrateful, and the ensuing cabinet reshuffle was not well received. Nor was Lawson happy, since the advice Thatcher was getting from Walters merely reinforced her determination not to join the ERM. By the autumn of 1989, Lawson had had enough and he resigned in late October. Thatcher moved Major back from the Foreign Office to replace Lawson as Chancellor and translated Douglas Hurd from the Home Office to the Foreign Office. And ironically, it was Major and Hurd who prevailed where Howe and Lawson had failed. For in October 1990, Thatcher finally agreed that Britain should indeed join the ERM. Having held up unexpectedly well in the polls since June 1987, public opinion had turned sharply and decisively against Thatcher and her colleagues early in 1989. That summer, the Conservatives suffered their first national defeat under her leadership, when Labour won 45 seats to the Tories' 32 in the elections to the European Parliament. Labour also moved ahead in the opinion polls, where it would remain for the rest of Thatcher's premiership. In November 1989, Sir Anthony Mayer, an obscure Europhile Tory backbencher, challenged Thatcher for the party leadership. She won by 314 votes to his 33, but the contest was nevertheless more disturbing than it was comforting. By late 1989, Labour was heading towards a 50% approval level. By February 1990, it was regarded as the most likely to win the next election. And by the spring of that year, Thatcher's personal rating had plummeted to 23%. Her cabinet colleagues were finding her increasingly impossible to work with, while many Tory MPs were coming to believe that the best way to preserve the Thatcher legacy and to keep their own parliamentary seats might be to get rid of Thatcher herself. By the early autumn of 1990, the signals for Thatcher were far from encouraging, both domestically and internationally, although it was unclear whether she noticed or even cared. Relations with most of her cabinet colleagues were more tense than ever in the aftermath of her Bruges speech. The Tory party was becoming increasingly divided over Europe. The poll tax had been a disaster, and the so-called Lawson economic boom seemed out of control. Stagflation was returning, and 1990 increasingly seemed like 1979 all over again, which cast serious doubt on Thatcher's repeated claim that the pain endured by many people and many places in the intervening years had been worth it. Thatcher had also lost out over the recent reunification of Germany in the aftermath of the fall of the Berlin Wall, and her influence in Washington and in Europe was seriously declining as a result. At home and overseas, she was increasingly isolated and increasingly embattled. But she gave no sign of it in her confident speech to the Conservative Party conference in October 1990, where she took all the credit she could for the fall of communism, vowed never to appease the Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein, insisted that Britain would not join the single European currency, and scorned and ridiculed the Labour opposition. The Tory party faithful demanded 10 more years of Margaret Thatcher. But on the 2nd of November 1990, Geoffrey Howe resigned. His ostensible reason was Thatcher's response to the late October meeting of the European Council in Rome, where there had been a push to establish a single European currency by 2000, which Thatcher vehemently opposed. When reporting back to the Commons, her prepared statement had passed off without incident. But in answer to a subsequent question, she rejected Delors' plans for a more consolidated continent with the defiant words, "No, no, no." Howe thereupon quit, declaring it was impossible for Britain to retain a position of influence in European affairs when Thatcher was so intransigent. He made his case with far greater force in the Commons, stressing that the United Kingdom should have joined the ERM much earlier, and ridiculing the Prime Minister's nightmare image of a European superstate. It was, Howe concluded, no longer possible to reconcile his instinct of loyalty to the Prime Minister with the true interests of Britain. It was a devastating resignation speech, and all the more so coming from a mild-mannered man and a long-suffering minister who was taking his belated revenge for the decade of bullying and humiliation which he had endured at Thatcher's hands. Michael Heseltine, who had been biding his time on the back benches since resigning from the cabinet in 1986, now seized his opportunity. He challenged Thatcher for the Tory leadership in a contest she was confident she would win. But her campaign team lacked focus, coordination and drive. Many backbenchers had had scarcely any dealings with her, and those with marginal seats feared they would lose them if she led the party into the next general election. Thatcher was also let down by poor staff work, and she made matters worse by departing to Paris on the eve of the ballot to attend a meeting of the Commission on Security and Cooperation in Europe. It was a celebration of the end of the Cold War, and Thatcher wanted to claim her share of the credit. But her decision to go made her seem even more remote from her MPs. In the first ballot, held on the 20th of November, she won 204 votes to Heseltine's 152, which was only four short of the margin of victory required. She returned to London, determined to fight on, but soon realised her support was ebbing away. She consulted her cabinet colleagues individually, most of whom told her that having failed to secure the requisite votes on the first ballot, she could not possibly win on the second. The next morning, the 22nd of November 1990, Thatcher announced her withdrawal from the contest, only staying on as Prime Minister until the party elected her successor as leader. But having grudgingly agreed to resign, Thatcher produced a final bravura parliamentary performance later the same day, replying to a Labour no-confidence motion which had been rendered pointless by her impending departure. Facing down her enemies on both sides of the House, she defended her record, demolished all interruptions, and restated the case that both domestically and internationally she had halted and reversed Britain's decline. It was an extraordinary display of parliamentary courage and command, and led many Tories to wonder how the party could have been so misguided as to ditch their most successful leader of modern times. But they had done the right thing. For while Thatcher would always retain some loyal supporters, she had stayed too long, and the Cabinet, the Commons, and the country had had enough of the bullying and berating, the hectoring and the handbagging.